Welcome to America Weekend. I am Paul Harris. And with the strains of Michael Jackson's Black or White, we lead now into a conversation about a couple of race-related decisions we're expecting from the United States Supreme Court, one of them possibly as early as Monday. Here to discuss them is Richard Wolf, who's a Supreme Court correspondent for USA Today. Rich, welcome to America Weekend.
Thank you. Good to be here.
What are the cases?
Well, we've got two cases that the Supreme Court is about to issue decisions on. One decision could come as early as Monday. One is an affirmative action case. It's called Fisher versus University of Texas. It's a case brought by a white girl, Abigail Fisher, who was denied admission to the University of Texas several years ago and says that that was based on her race. The other is a case out of Alabama. It's called Shelby County v. Holder, and it's a challenge to the 1965 Voting Rights Act.
Now, on the first case about the college admissions, I remember a decade ago when the Supreme Court had a case like this, can we use affirmative action and race to diversify our student body? And the court upheld the right of colleges to do that, particularly public colleges, when they're deciding who to admit. What's different about this case?
Well, first of all, the membership of the court is different. That was a case out of the University of Michigan. It was the law school. It was a policy that they used, and the court decision was written by Sandra Day O'Connor. It was a narrow decision, and she said that it's still permissible to use race, but only as one of several factors, never using race alone to decide between two students. Justice Anthony Kennedy, who's now the swing vote on the court, O'Connor is now retired, Kennedy dissented in that decision, so he didn't agree with it. And Justice Samuel Alito, several years ago, replaced O'Connor. So you have a different court. You have a court where Alito is pretty much against affirmative action policies, where O'Connor was narrowly for them, and Kennedy is now clearly the swing vote.
Sounds like you're telling me that this has a pretty good chance of going the other way.
Well, yes, but Kennedy tends to find a way to split the baby in a lot of these cases, to rule narrowly, to not move the court much further than the court, than he feels it should go. Chief Justice John Roberts also professes to be a minimalist, in other words, somebody who doesn't want the court to be more than sort of a neutral umpire. And so it's very possible that this decision will be somehow a narrow decision, maybe going a little bit further against affirmative action than the 2003 decision in Michigan, but not wiping out the use of racial preferences for public universities and conceivably even private schools, because most private colleges and universities get federal money, so they could be implicated as well.
I see.
It's probably not going to be that broad and sweeping a decision, but it's clear that four and maybe five justices on the court do think that when it comes down to a decision on two students and the school makes that decision based on race, that ought not to happen.
Now, you say it could be four, it could be five. Five is the magic number on the court because there are nine justices, but in this case, one of them is not participating. Elena Kagan has recused herself. Why?
Right. Well, when a justice recuses himself or herself, it's not announced why, but the justice is making that decision on his or her own. And in this case, Justice Kagan, before she came to the court, was the U.S. Solicitor General. That's the person in the Justice Department who basically argues the cases before the Supreme Court. So the presumption is that at some point in time, she was involved enough in this case as it moved its way up toward the Supreme Court that she doesn't feel that she ought to be participating. So you have three liberal justices or three justices who are left of center who are likely to favor the continued use of affirmative action in some way, four who are likely to oppose it, Kennedy in the middle. So you wouldn't have a decision, a 5-4 decision. What you could have is either a decision that goes to some degree against the University of Texas's policy and perhaps more sweeping than that in a 5-3, or you could have a 4-4 situation where Kennedy goes with the liberals, and that would basically be a nothing decision. That would the system, the University of Texas's program could continue. The challenge is being brought by the white woman, Abigail Fisher. She would lose in a 4-4 tie, in essence.
If race is no longer allowed to be used in a decision about whether you admit a student to college, could they say, okay, you know what, we're not going to do race, but since a lot of our minority applicants tend to come from lower income homes, we're going to make that a bigger factor here because we still want to have a diverse campus. Can they have other things that kind of get around this but achieve the same thing?
Yes, and the schools and universities around the country would tell you that they already do that. That, in other words, when they're considering applicants for admission, they don't simply look at SAT scores and high school grades and then say, okay, now that we know exactly how good or bad this student is, we're going to add race and only race. You know, race is just one factor that schools use. They already do use a lot of those other factors. And in 10 states, they have banned the use of racial preferences. There's a couple of outliers there. Texas is one of those states, but after the decision in Michigan 10 years ago, Texas kind of amended their law and said, well, you can use race a little bit after other factors just to kind of even out the class, and that's that's at the heart of this challenge. But so in a lot of states, including California, including Florida, including Texas, race is already not used under state law. Sometimes it's a state statute, sometimes it's a voter referendum. And what they're doing instead, because they still have an interest, and schools and universities have an interest in having a diverse population just so that students aren't going to an all-white, say, university, is they use other means often to try to achieve the same ends. So if they go after, are you or are you not maybe the first in your family to be able to attend college? What, in other words, what's the educational attainment history of your family? More likely than that, they would say, what's your family income? And by going after other factors, they can try to achieve the same goals. Lots of states have been able to do that. Some of the most competitive colleges, however, say the University of California, Berkeley, and others like it, UCLA, have a tough time competing against colleges in states that don't have those laws, say the University of Virginia, that can still use racial preferences. Those colleges can lose some of their best potential minority applicants to the schools that do use the preferences.
The other case that the court is going to give us a decision on soon has to do with the Voting Rights Act. Explain that, if you would.
Well, the Voting Rights Act is sort of the major civil rights legislation of our time, right? It was passed in 1965, and the key section of that act says that certain states, mostly in the South, and parts of other states, it's a total of 9 states in full and about parts of 6 others, can't change their voting practices. That's anything from these days every 10-year redistricting, all the way down to if you want to move a polling place. You can't do anything that affects voting without checking in with the federal government first. And that's because those states, it was determined in 1965 and updated in 1972, are the ones with a history of discrimination. Now, of course, that discrimination used to be pretty terrible. It was things like poll taxes. So ever since then, through various congressional reauthorizations, the most recent one being in 2006, the same list of states and municipalities has applied. Those are the ones that have to check in with Uncle Sam to find out if they can move a polling place, and no one else has to do that, although others can be sued in retrospect after they do if somebody feels that there's discrimination afoot. And what the justices, clearly, again, the same basic split on the court, conservatives on one side, liberals on the other, Kennedy in the middle, what the justices feel uncomfortable about is why those states and cities and counties and towns are the ones that have to check with the federal government and others don't. It's a formula that hasn't been updated since 1972, and therefore 4, maybe 5 justices on the court feel that it may be unconstitutional.
What a fascinating term you're having here between the gay marriage stuff and hearing cases like this and the others. Is this an unusually great year for your job?
Well, yes, it is. I'm fairly new to the beat. I only came onto the beat during the health care debate last year, and obviously the health care decision was a huge one that the court devoted 6 hours over 3 days to. Other than the health care case in the previous term, there were a couple of other major cases, including immigration. But there are several people who would argue that this term is even more important, potentially more important, and possibly because of these decisions on race that are are going to come down in the next couple months. Obviously, you mentioned same-sex marriage as well. We have the two cases there, Proposition 8 in California and the DOMA law.
Fascinating stuff, and congratulations on stepping right into such a high-profile position there. Richard Wolf, Supreme Court correspondent for USA Today, thanks for joining me here today.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Paul Harris. The show is America Weekend on Facebook, on Twitter, by email, and, of course, on your radio from the Envision Radio Networks.